The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 5, Side 2.
Toward morning we come across another haystack. With even more difficulty than yesterday, we climb into it. We fall asleep. Something to be thankful for. When we wake up, it is nearly evening. How much can a man endure? 5 days now we have been on the run. Not far away we see a yurt with an open shed near it. Quietly we creep up to it. Coarse millet had been strewn on the ground. We stuff the briefcase with it, try to munch some, but we cannot swallow. Our mouths are too dry. Suddenly we catch sight of a huge samovar near the yurt, big enough to hold several gallons. We crawl up to it. We turn the tap. The bloody thing is empty. When we tip it, we get a couple of mouthfuls. We stagger on again, staggering and falling. Lying down, you breathe more easily. We can no longer get up off our backs. First we have to roll over onto our bellies, then raise ourselves onto all fours, then swaying onto our feet. Even this leaves us out of breath. We have grown so thin that our bellies seem stuck to our backbones. As dawn approaches, we cover some 200 meters, no more, and lie down. That morning, no haystack came our way. There was some kind of burrow in a hill, dug by an animal. We lay in it through the day, but could not get to sleep. That day it got colder, and we felt a chill from the ground. Or perhaps our blood was no longer warming us. We tried to chew some macaroni. Suddenly, I see a line of soldiers advancing, with red shoulder tabs. They're surrounding us. Zhdanok gives me a shake. You're imagining things. It's a herd of horses. Yes, it was a mirage. We lay down again. The day was endless. Suddenly a jackal arrived, coming home to his hole. We put some macaroni down for him and crawled away, hoping to lure him after us, stab him and eat him. But he wouldn't touch it. He went away. To one side of us there was a slope, downhill a little, the salt flats of a dried-up lake, and on the other bank a yurt and smoke drifting in the air. 6 days have gone by. We have reached the limit. We see red tabs in our hallucinations. Our tongues are stuck to the roofs of our mouths. If we pass water at all, there is blood in it. It's no good. Tonight we must get food and water at any price. We'll go over there to the yurt. If they refuse us, we'll take it by force. I remember the old fugitive Grigory Kudla and his war cry, Mach Madeira, meaning stop asking and grab. Collier and I come to an understanding. At the right moment I will say, Mach Madeira. In the darkness we crept quietly toward the yurt. There was a well, but no bucket. Not far away a saddled horse stood at a hitching post. We glanced through the narrow opening. By the light of an oil lamp we see a Kazakh couple and some children. We knocked and went in. I said, Salaam. And all the time there were big spots in front of my eyes and I was afraid of falling. Inside there was a low, round table, even lower than our modernist designers make them, for the beshbarmak. Round the yurt were benches covered with felt. There was a big, metal-bound chest. The Kazakh muttered something in reply and looked sullen. He was not a bit pleased to see us. To make myself look important, and anyway I needed to conserve my strength, I sat down and put the briefcase on the table. I'm in charge of a geological survey team, and this is my driver. We've left our transport back in the steppe with the others, 5 or maybe 7 kilometers from here. The radiator leaks and the water's all run out. We ourselves haven't had anything to eat for 3 days. We're starving. Give us something to eat and drink, Aksakal, and tell us what you think we should do. But the Kazakh screws up his eyes and offers no food and drink. What you name, boss? He asks. I had it already once, but my head is buzzing and I've forgotten. Ivanov, I answer. Stupid, of course. Come on, then. Sell us some groceries, Aksakal. No, go to my neighbour. Is it far? 2 kilometres. I sit there on my dignity, but Kolya can't hold out any longer, seizes a griddle cake and tries to chew it, though it is obviously hard work for him. Suddenly the Kazakh picks up a whip with a short handle and a long leather lash and threatens Zhdanok with it. I get to my feet. So that's the sort of people you are. That's your famous hospitality. Now the Kazakh is prodding Zhdanok in the back with a whip handle, trying to drive him out of the yurt. I give the command. Mach Madeira! I take out my knife and tell the Kazakh, in the corner, lie down. The Kazakh dives through a curtain, I'm right behind him. He may have a gun there, may shoot us at any moment. But he flops on the bed, shouting, "Take it all! I won't say anything!" "Oh, you miserable cur, you! What do I want with your all? Why couldn't you give me the little bit I asked for in the first place?" To Kolya, I say, "Keep your eyes peeled." I stand by the door with my knife. The Kazakh woman is screaming. The children start crying. "Tell your wife we won't hurt any of you. We just want to eat. Is there any meat?" He spreads his hands. "Yok." But Kolya pokes about in the yurt and produces dried mutton out of a meat safe. "Why did you lie?" Kolya also grabs a basin with barsaki in it, lumps of dough, deep fried. I suddenly realize that there is kumis in the jugs on the table. Kolya and I drink. With every swig, life comes back to us. What a drink. My head begins to spin, but intoxication seems to help me. I feel stronger all the time. Kolya is beginning to enjoy himself. He passes some money to me. There turn out to be 28 rubles. There's probably more tucked away somewhere. We drop the dried mutton into a sack and scoop barsaki, griddle cakes and sweets of some sort, dirty satin cushions, into another. Kolya also pinches a dish of roasted mutton scraps. A knife. That's something we really need. We try not to forget anything. Wooden spoons. Salt. I carry the sack out. I come back and take a bucket of water. I take a blanket, a spare bridle, the whip. He mutters to himself. He doesn't like this. How is he going to catch us? "Right, then," I tell the Kazakh. "Let that be a lesson to you, and mind you don't forget it. You should be more friendly to your guests. We would have gone on our knees to you for a bucket of water and a dozen barsaki. We do no harm to decent people. Here are your final instructions. Lie where you are without stirring. We have friends outside." I leave Kolya outside the door while I lug the rest of the loot over to the horse. I suppose we should be hurrying, but my mind works calmly. I take the horse to the well and let it drink its fill. It, too, has quite a job ahead of it. It will have to carry its excessive load all through the night. I drink from the well myself. So does Kolya. Just then some geese come up to us. Kolya has a weakness for poultry. "Shall we grab the geese?" he says. "Shall we wring their necks? It'll make too much noise. Don't waste time." I let down the stirrups and tighten the girths. Zhdanok puts the blanket behind the saddle and climbs onto it from the well wall. He takes the bucket of water in his hands. We have tied the two sacks together and slung them over the horse's back. I get into the saddle. And so, by the light of the stars, we ride off eastward to throw our pursuers off the trail. The horse objected to having two riders, strangers at that, and kept tossing its head, trying to turn back toward home. We mastered it somehow. It set off briskly. There were lights nearby. We made a detour. Kolya sang quietly in my ear. "Out on the range where the wind blows free, a cowboy's life is the life for me, with a horse I can trust beneath me." "I saw his passport, too," said Kolya. "Why didn't you take it? A passport always comes in handy. You can give them a peep at the cover, not too close." On the road, we took frequent drinks of water and snacks without dismounting. Our mood was entirely different now. All we wanted now was to gallop as far away as we could before daylight. We heard the cries of birds. A lake. It would be a long way around it, and we grudged the time. Kolya dismounted and led the horse along a slippery causeway. We got across. But we suddenly noticed. No blanket. It had slipped off. We had left a trail. This was very bad. From the Kazakh's place, many paths led in all directions, but if they found the blanket and drew a line from the yurt to that point, our route would be clear. Should we go back and look for it? There was no time. In any case, they must know we were going north. We called a halt. I held the horse by a rein. We ate and drank, endlessly. The water was nearly down to the bottom of the bucket. We could hardly believe it. Course, due north. The horse wouldn't break into a trot, but walked quickly, at 8 to 10 kilometers an hour. In 6 nights, we had notched only 150 kilometers, but that night we did another 70. If we hadn't zigzagged about, we should be on the Irtysh by now. Dawn, but nowhere to hide. We rode on. It was getting dangerous. Then we saw a deep hollow, almost a hole. We took the horse down into it and ate and drank again. Suddenly, a motorcycle stuttered nearby. That was bad. There was a road. We must find a safer hiding place. We climbed out and looked around. Not too far off there was a dead and deserted Kazakh village. The years 1930 to 1933 left many such ruined villages dotted about Kazakhstan. First Budeni passed through with his cavalry. To this day there is not a single Kolkhoz called after him, not a single picture of him anywhere in Kazakhstan. Then famine. We made our way there. We shed our load between the three walls of a ruined house, then hobbled the horse and turned it out to graze. But there was no sleep that day. With the Kazakh and the blanket, we had left a trail. Evening, 7 days now. The horse was grazing some way off. We went after it, and it shied away, evaded us. Kolya grabbed it by the mane, but it dragged him along and he fell. It had freed its front legs, and now there was no holding it. We hunted it for 3 hours, wearing ourselves out, drove it in among the ruins, tried to slip a noose made from our belts around its neck, but still it wouldn't give in. We bit our lips, but we had to abandon it. All we had left was the bridle and the whip. We ate and drank our last water. We shouldered the sacks with the food and the empty bucket, and off we went. Today we had the strength for it. The following morning caught us in an awkward spot, and we had to hide in some bushes not far from a road. Not the best of places. We could be spotted. A cart rattled by. We didn't sleep that day either. As the 8th day ended, we set off again. When we had gone a little way, we suddenly felt soft earth underfoot. The plough had been here. We went on and saw headlights along the road. Careful now. There was a young moon up among the clouds. Yet another dead and ruined Kazakh hamlet. Farther on, the lights of a village and the words of a song reached our ears. Hey, lads, unharness the horses! We put the sacks down among the ruins and made for the village with the briefcase and bucket. We had our knives in our pockets. Here's the first house, with a grunting piglet. If only we'd met him out on the step. A lad rode towards us on a bike. Hey, pal, we've got a truck over there. We're moving grain. Where can we get some water for the radiator? The boy got off, went ahead of us, and pointed. There was a tank on the edge of the village. Probably the cattle drank from it. We dipped the bucket in and carried it away full without taking a drink. We parted with the lad, then sat down and drank and drank. We half-emptied the bucket at one go. We were thirstier than ever today because we'd eaten our fill. There seemed to be a slight chill in the air, and there was real grass under our feet. There must be a river near. We must look for it. We walk and walk. The grass is higher. There are bushes. A willow. Where they are, there is always water. Reeds. Water. No doubt a backwater of the Irtysh. Now we can splash around and wash ourselves. Reeds 2 meters high. Ducks start up from under our feet. We can breathe freely here. We shan't come to grief here. And this was when, for the first time in 8 days, the stomach discovered that it was still working. After 8 days out of action, what torment it was. Birth pains are probably no worse. Then back we went to the abandoned village. There we lit a fire between the walls and boiled some dried mutton. We should have used the night to move on, but all we wanted was to eat and eat insatiably. We stuffed ourselves until we could hardly move. Then, feeling pleased with life, we set off to look for the Irtysh. At a fork in the road, something happened for the first time in 8 days. We quarrelled. I said right, Stanok said left. I felt sure that it should be right, but he wouldn't listen. Another of the dangers that lie in wait for escapers, falling out with one another. When you are on the run, one of your number must be allowed to have the last word, otherwise you are in trouble. Determined to have my way, I went off to the right. I walked 100 meters and still heard no footsteps behind me. My heart ached. We couldn't just part like that. I sat down by a haystack and looked back. Kolya was coming. I hugged him. We walked on side by side as though nothing had happened. There are more bushes now and the air is chillier. We walked to the edge of a sharp drop. Down below, the Irtysh splashes and babbles and playfully breathes on us. We are overjoyed. We find a haystack and burrow into it. What about it, tracker dogs? Still think you can find us? You haven't a hope. We fall into a heavy sleep. We were awakened by a shot, and dogs barking quite near. Was this it, then? Was our freedom to end so soon? We clung together and stopped breathing. A man went by with a dog. A hunter. We fell into an even deeper sleep and slept the day through. This was how we spent our ninth day. When it got dark, we set off along the river. 3 days had gone by since we left a trail. The dog handlers would only be looking for us along the Irtysh by now. They would realize that we were making for the water. If we went along the bank, we might easily stumble into an ambush. Besides, it was hard work. We had to go around bends, creeks, reed beds. We needed a boat. A light, a little house on the riverbank, the splash of oars, then silence. We lay low and waited for some time. They put the light out. We went quietly down to the water. There was the boat, and a pair of oars, splendid. Their owner might have taken them with him. The sailor leaves his troubles ashore. My native element. Quietly to begin with, without splashing. Once out in midstream, I rowed hard. We move on, down the Irtysh, and from around a bend a brightly lit steamer comes towards us. So many lights. The windows are all ablaze, the whole ship rings with dance music. Passengers, free and happy, stroll on the deck and sit in the restaurant, not realizing how happy they are, not even aware of their freedom, and how cozy it is in their cabins. In this way, we travelled more than 20 kilometres downstream. Our provisions were running out. The sensible thing would be to stock up again while it was still night. We heard cocks crowing, put into shore, and quietly climbed toward the sound. A little house, no dog, a cattle shed, a cow with a calf, hens. Stanok is fond of poultry, but I say we'll take the calf. We untie it, Stanok leads it to the boat, while I, in the most literal sense, wipe out our tracks. Otherwise it will be obvious to the tracker dogs that we're travelling by boat. The calf came quietly as far as the bank, but stubbornly refused to step into the boat. It was as much as the two of us could do to get him in and make him lie down. Stanok sat on him to hold him down, while I rowed. Once in the clear, we would kill him. But that was our mistake. Trying to carry him alive, the calf started getting to his feet, threw Stanok off, and heaved his forelegs into the water. All hands on deck, Stanok hangs on to the calf's hindquarters. I hang on to Stanok. We all lean too far to one side, and water pours in on us. We're as near as need be to drowning in the Irtysh. Still, we drag the calf back in, but the boat is very low in the water and must be bailed out. Even that must wait, though, till we kill the calf. I take the knife and try to sever the tendon at the back of his neck. I know the place is there somewhere, but either I can't find it or the knife is too blunt. It won't go through. The calf trembles, struggles, gets more and more agitated, and I'm agitated too. I try to cut his throat, but that is no good either. He bellows, kicks, looks as if to jump clean out of the boat or sink us. He wants to live, but we have to live too. I saw a way, but cannot cut deep enough. He rocks the boat, kicks its sides. The silly idiot will sink us any minute now. Because he is so nasty and so stubborn, a red hatred for him sweeps over me, as though he were my worst enemy, and I start savagely, randomly pricking and jabbing him with the knife. Is this not like the hatred our oppressors feel for us as they destroy us? His blood spurts forth and sprays us. He bellows loudly and kicks out desperately. Stanok clamps his hand round the calf's muzzle. The boat rocks, and I stab and stab again. To think that at one time I couldn't hurt a mouse or a fly, but this is no time for pity. It's him or us. At last he lay still. We started hurriedly scooping out water with a bale and some tin cans, each of us using both hands. Then we rowed on. The current drew us into a side channel. Ahead lay an island. This would be a good place to hide. It would soon be morning. We wedged the boat well into the reeds. We dragged the calf and all our goods onto the bank, and to make the boat still safer, strewed reeds over it. It wasn't easy to haul the calf by its legs up the steep overhang, but once there, there was grass waist high and trees, like a fairy tale. We had spent several years in the desert by now. We had forgotten what forests and grass and rivers were like. It was getting light. The calf looked aggrieved, we thought. But thanks to this little friend of ours, we could now live for a while on the island. We sharpened the knife on a fragment of file made from our Katyusha. I had never before skinned a beast, but now I was learning. I slit the belly, pulled back the skin, and removed the entrails. In the depths of the wood, we lit a fire and started stewing veal with oats, a whole bucket full of it. A feast, and best of all, we feel at ease. At ease because we are on an island. The island segregates us from mean people. There are good people, too, but somehow runaways don't often come across them. Only mean ones. It is a hot, sunny day. No need for painful contortions to hide in a jackal's hole. The grass is thick and lush. Those who trample it every day don't know how precious it is, don't know what it means to plunge into it breast high, to bury your face in it. We roam about the island. It is overrun by dog roses, and the hips are already ripe. We eat them endlessly. We eat more soup, and stew some more veal. We make kasha with kidneys. We feel light-hearted. We look back at our difficult journey and find plenty to laugh at. We think of them waiting back there for our sketch, cursing us, explaining themselves to the administration. We make a play of it. We roar with laughter. We tear bark from a thick trunk and burn in the following inscription with red-hot wire. Here, on their way to freedom in October 1950, two innocent people sentenced to hard labor for life took refuge. Let this sign of our presence remain. Out in the wilds here it will not help our pursuers, and some day people will read it. We decide not to hurry on. All that we ran away for, we have, our freedom. It can hardly be more complete when we reach Omsk or Moscow. We also have warm, sunny days, clean air, green grass, leisure, and meat in plenty. Only we have no bread and miss it greatly. We lived on the island for nearly a week, from our 10th to the beginning of our 16th day. In the thickest part of the wood, we built ourselves a shelter of dry boughs. It was cold at night even there, but we made up for lost sleep in the daytime. The sun shone on us all this time. We drank a lot, trying to store water as camels do. We sat serenely, looking for hours through the branches at life over yonder on shore. Over there, vehicles went by. The grass was being mown again, the second crop this summer. No one dropped in on us. One afternoon, while we were dozing in the grass, enjoying the last rays of the sun, we suddenly heard the sound of an axe at work on the island. Cautiously raising ourselves, we saw, not far away, a man lopping branches and moving gradually toward us. In a fortnight, with no means of shaving, I had grown a beard, a terrible reddish bristling bush, and was now a typical escaped convict. But Stanok had no growth at all. He was like a smooth-faced boy. So I pretended to be asleep and sent him to head the man off, ask for a smoke, tell him that we were tourists from Omsk, and find out where he came from himself. If needs be, I was ready to act. Collier went over and had a chat with him. They lit up. He turned out to be a Kazakh from a nearby Kolkhoz. Afterwards, we saw him walk along the bank, get into his boat, and row off without the branches he had cut. What did this mean? Was he in a hurry to report us? Or perhaps it was the other way round. Perhaps he was afraid that we might inform on him. You can do time for wood-stealing, too. That was what our lives had come to. Everybody feared everybody else. What did you say we were? Climbers. I didn't know whether to laugh or to cry. Stanek always made a muddle of things. I told you to say hikers. What would climbers be doing on the flat step? No, we couldn't stay there. Our life of bliss was over. We dragged everything back to the boat and cast off. Although it was daytime, we had to leave quickly. Collier lay on the bottom, out of sight, so that from a little way off it would look as if there was just one man in the boat. I rowed, keeping to the middle of the Irtish. One problem was where to buy bread. Another was that we were now coming to inhabited places, and I could no longer go unshaven. We planned to sell one of our suits in Omsk, buy tickets several stations down on the line, and get away by train. Toward evening we reached a boy-keeper's hut and went up there. We found a woman alone. She was frightened and began rushing around. "I'll call my husband at once," and off she went, with me following to keep an eye on her. Suddenly Zhdanok called out from the house in alarm, "Zora!" "Damn you and your big mouth. We had agreed that I would call myself Viktor Alexandrovich." I went back. Two men, one with a hunting rifle. "Who are you?" "Tourists from Omsk. We want to buy some groceries." And to lull their suspicions, "Let's go into the house. Why are you so inhospitable?" It worked, and they relaxed. "We've got nothing here. Maybe at the Sovkhoz, 2 kilometers farther down." We went to the boat and travelled another 20 kilometers downstream. It was a moonlit night. We climbed the steep bank, a little house, no light burning. We knocked, a Kazakh came out, and this first man we saw sold us half a loaf and a quarter of a sack of potatoes. We also bought a needle and thread, probably rather rash of us. We asked for a razor too, but he was beardless and had no use for one. Still, he was the first kind person we had met. We got ambitious and asked whether there was any fish. His wife rose and brought us two little fishes and said, "Besh denga, no money." This was more than we had hoped for. She was giving them to us free. These really were kind people. I started stowing the fish in my sack, but she pulled them back again. "Besh denga, 5 rubles, the man of the house explained. The narrator misunderstands the Kazakh words "besh denga, 5 rubles, as Russian "bez deneg," without money. "Ah, so that's it. No, we won't take them. Too dear." We rode on for the rest of the night. Next day, our 17th on the run, we hid the boat in the bushes and slept in some hay. We spent the 18th and 19th in the same way, trying not to meet people. We had all we needed: water, fire, meat, potatoes, salt, a bucket. On the precipitous right bank, there were leafy woods, on the left bank, meadows and a lot of hay. In the daytime, we lit a fire among the bushes, made a stew, and slept. But Omsk was not far off, and we should be compelled to mix with people, which meant that I must have a razor. I felt completely helpless. With neither razor nor scissors, I couldn't imagine how I was going to rid myself of all that hair. Pluck it out, a hair at a time. On a moonlit night, we saw a mound high over the Irtysh. Was it, we wondered, a lookout post from the times of Yermak? We climbed up to look. In the moonlight, we saw a mysterious dead township of adobe houses, probably also from the early 30s. What would burn, they had burned. The mud brick walls they had knocked down. Some of the people they had tied to the tails of their horses. Here was a place the tourists never visited. It had not rained once in those 2 weeks, but the nights were already very cold. To speed things up, I did most of the rowing, while Zhdanok sat at the tiller, freezing. And sure enough, on the 20th night, he started asking for a fire and hot water to warm himself. I put him at the oars, but he shivered feverishly and could think of nothing but a fire. His comrade in flight could not deny him a fire. Collier should have known that and denied himself. But that was the way with Zhdanok. He could never control his desires. Remember how he had snatched the griddle cake from the table, and what a temptation the poultry was to him. He kept shivering and begging for a fire, but they would be keeping their eyes skinned for us all along the Irtysh. It was surprising that no search party had crossed our path so far, that we had not been spotted on a moonlit night in the middle of the Irtysh and stopped. Then we saw a light on the higher bank. Kolya stopped begging for a fire and wanted to go inside for a warm-up. That would be even more dangerous. I should never have agreed. We had gone through so much, suffered so many hardships, and for what? But how could I refuse him? Perhaps he was seriously ill, and he could refuse himself nothing. In the light of an oil lamp, 2 Kazakhs, a man and a woman, were sleeping on the floor. They jumped up in fright. "I have a sick man here," I explained. "Let him get warm. We are on official business from the Grain Procurement Agency. They ferried us over from the other side." "Lie down," the Kazakh said. Kolya lay down on a heap of felt, and I thought it would look better if I lay down a bit too. It was the first roof we had had over our heads since our escape, but I was on hot bricks. I couldn't even lie still, let alone go to sleep. I felt as though we had betrayed ourselves, stepped into a trap with our eyes open. The old man went out, wearing nothing but his underwear, otherwise I would have gone after him, and was away a long time. I heard whispering in Kazakh behind the curtain. "Young men." "Who are you?" I asked. "Boy keepers?" "No, we're from the Abai State Livestock Farm, number 1 in the Republic." We couldn't have chosen a worse place. Where there was a state farm, there was officialdom and police, and the best farm in the Republic at that. They must be really keen. I pressed Collier's hand. "I'm off to the boat. Come after me, with the briefcase." Out loud, I said, "We shouldn't have left the provisions on the bank." I went through to the entranceway and tried the outer door. It was locked. "That's it, then." I went back in, alerted Collier by pulling his sleeve, and returned to the door. The carpenters had made a botched job of it, and one of the lower planks was shorter than the rest. I shoved my hand through, stretched my arm as far as I could, and felt around. Ah, there we were. It was held by a peg outside. I dislodged it. I went out, hurried down to the bank. The boat was where it had been. I stood waiting in broad moonlight. But there was no sign of Collier. This was dreadful. Evidently he couldn't make himself get up. He was enjoying an extra minute in the warmth. Or else they had seized him. I should have to go and rescue him. I climbed the cliff again. Four people were coming toward me from the house, Zhdanok among them. Zora! He shouted. Zora! Again. Come here, they want to see our papers. He wasn't carrying the briefcase, as I had told him to. I go up to them. A new arrival with a Kazakh accent says, Your papers. I behave as calmly as I can. Who are you, then? I'm the commandant. All right, then, I say reassuringly. Let's go. You can check our papers any time. There's more light in the house there. We go into the house. I slowly lifted the briefcase from the floor and went over to the lamp, looking for an opportunity to sidestep them and dash out of the house, and talking all the time to distract them. Welcome to see our papers any time, of course. Papers must always be checked in such circumstances. You can't be too careful. We had a case once in the procurement agency. My hand was on the lock now, ready to undo the briefcase. They crowded around me. Then I butted the commandant with my shoulder. He bumped into the old man, and they both fell. I gave the young man on my right a straight punch on the jaw. They yelled, they howled. Mahmadera, I shouted, and bounded with the briefcase through the inner, then the outer door. Then Collier shouted after me from the entranceway. Zora, they've got me! He was clinging to the doorpost while they tried to pull him back inside. I tugged at his arm but couldn't free him. Then I braced myself against the doorpost with my foot and gave such a heave that Collier flew over my head as I fell to the ground. Two of them flung themselves on top of me. I don't know how I wriggled out from under them. Our precious briefcase was left behind. I ran to the cliff and bounded down it. Behind me I hear someone saying in Russian, Use the axe on him! The axe! Probably trying to scare us. Otherwise they would be speaking Kazakh. I can almost feel their outstretched hands on me. I stumble and almost fall. Collier is in the boat already. Good thing they didn't have a gun, I shout. I pushed the boat out and was up to my knees in water before I jumped into it. The Kazakhs were reluctant to get wet. They ran along the bank yelling, Gir, gir, gir! I shouted back at them, Thought you had us, didn't you, you bastards? Yes, it was lucky they had no gun. I made the boat race with the current. They bayed after us, running along the bank, until a creek barred their way. I took off my two pairs of trousers, naval and civilian, and wrung them out. My teeth were chattering. Well, Collier, I said, we got warmed up all right. He was silent. It was obviously time to say goodbye to the Irtysh. At daybreak we must go ashore and thumb rides the rest of the way to Omsk. It wasn't so very far now. The Katyusha and the salt had been left behind in the briefcase. And where could we get a razor? It wasn't worth asking myself how we could dry our clothes. Look, on the bank there, a boat and a hut. Obviously a boy keeper. We went ashore and knocked. No light came on. A deep male voice. Who is it? Let us in for a warm-up. Our boat capsized and we nearly drowned. There was a lot of fumbling, then the door opened. In the dimly lit entrance a sturdy old man, Russian, stood to one side of the door, arms raised, threatening us with an axe. He could bring it down on one of us, and there would be no stopping him. I tried to reassure him. Don't be afraid, we're from Omsk. We've been on business to the Abai State Farm. We intended to go by boat to the district center downstream, but there were nets in the shallows a bit higher up. We fouled them and turned over. He still looked suspicious and didn't lower his axe. Where had I seen him before? In what picture? An old man out of a folk tale with his grey mane, his grey beard. At last he decided to answer. You were going to Zheletsyanka, you mean? Fine, now we know where we are. That's right, Zheletsyanka. The worst of it is my briefcase sank and there's 150 rubles in it. We bought some meat at the state farm, but we have no use for it now. Perhaps you'll buy it from us. Zhdanok went to get the meat. The old man led me into the inner room where there was a kerosene lamp and a sporting gun on the wall. Now we'll check your papers. I tried to speak as confidently as I could. I always keep my documents on me. It's lucky they were in my top pocket or they would be soaked. I'm Stolyarov, Viktor Alexandrovich, representing the Provincial Livestock Administration. Now I must quickly seize the initiative. What about you? I'm a boy keeper. Name and patronymic? Just then Collier arrived, and the old man didn't mention papers again. He said that he couldn't afford to buy meat, but that he could give us a drink of tea. We sat with him about an hour. He warmed up some tea for us and a fire of wood chips, gave us bread, and even cut off a piece of fat bacon. We talked about the navigation channels of the Irtysh, how much we had paid for our boat, where to sell it. He did most of the talking. He looked at us with compassion in his wise old eyes, and it seemed to me that he knew all about us, that he was a real human being. I even felt like confiding in him, but it wouldn't have helped us. He obviously had no razor. He was as shaggy as everything else in the forest. Besides, it was less dangerous for him not to know. Otherwise, it would be, you knew and didn't tell. We left him our veal, and he gave us some matches. He came out to see us off and explained which side we should keep to at which points. We pushed off and rowed quickly to get as far away as possible in our last night. They would be looking for us on the right bank, so now we hugged the left most of the time. The moon was hidden by our bank, but the sky was clear, and we saw a boat following the steep wooded right bank, going downstream like ourselves, but not as fast. Could it be an MVD operations group? We were following parallel courses. I decided to brazen it out, rowed strongly, and came closer to them.
Hey, pal, where are you headed?
Omsk. And where are you from? Pavlodar. Why so far? We're moving for good. His voice, with its peasant O's, was too uneducated for an operations officer. He answered unhesitatingly, and he even seemed glad to see us. His wife was sleeping in the boat, while he spent the night at the oars. I looked in. It was more like an ox wagon, crammed with goods and chattels, heaped high with packages. I did a bit of quick thinking. A meeting like this, on our last night in our last hours on the river, if he's pulling up his roots, they must be carrying provisions and money and passports and clothing and even a razor, and no one anywhere will wonder where they are. He's alone, and there are two of us. His wife doesn't count. I'll travel on his passport. Collier can dress up like a woman. He's small, has a smooth face. We'll mould him a figure. They must surely have a suitcase to help us look like genuine travellers. Any driver we meet will drop us in Omsk this very morning. Whoever heard of a Russian river without pirates? Fate is cruel, but what else can we do? Now that we have left a trail on the river, this is our last, our only chance. It's a pity to rob a working man of his belongings, but whoever took pity on us, and whoever would? All this flashed through my mind, and through Zhdanok's, too. In a moment, I only had to ask quietly, "Uh-huh," and he quietly replied, "Mahmadera." I get steadily nearer, and am now forcing their boat toward the steep bank, toward the dark forest. I must be quick to prevent them from reaching the next bend in the river, in case the forest ends there. I change my voice to one of authority and give my orders. "Attention! We are an MVD operations group. Put into shore. I want to inspect your papers." The rower threw down his oars. Had he lost his head, or was he perhaps overjoyed to find that we were policemen and not robbers? "Of course," he said. "You can inspect them here, or on the river." I said, "Put into the shore, and that's what you'll do, and be quick about it." We got close to them. Our sides were almost touching. We jumped across. He scrambled with difficulty over his bundles, and we saw that he had a limp. His wife woke up. "Is it far now?" The young man handed over his passport. "What about your draft card?" "I was invalided out. Wounded, I'm exempt. Here's the certificate." I saw a gleam of metal in the prow of their boat, an axe. I signalled Collier to remove it. He rushed too abruptly and seized the axe. The woman felt that something was wrong and set up a howl. "What's all that noise?" I said sternly. "Cut it out. We're looking for runaways, criminals, and an axe is as good a weapon as any." She calmed down a little. I gave Collier his orders. "Lieutenant, slip down to the observation post. Captain Vorobyov should be there." The name and rank came to me automatically. I'll tell you why. We'd left a pal of ours, Captain Vorobyov, behind in Ekibastuts, confined to the cells for trying to escape. Kolya understood. He was to see whether there was anyone around up top, or whether we could act. Up he ran. In the meantime, I carried on questioning and inspecting. My suspect obligingly struck matches for me. I ran through their passports and certificates. His age was just right, too. the veteran was under 40. He had worked as a boy keeper. Now they had sold their home and their cow. He would have all the money with him, of course. They were going to seek their fortune. They couldn't get there in a day, so they'd set off by night. A rare chance, an extraordinary chance, above all because no one would miss them. But what did we need from them? Did we need their lives? No, I had never murdered, and I didn't want to now. An interrogator, or an operations officer, when he was tormenting me, yes, but I couldn't raise my hand against ordinary working people. Should I take their money? All right, but just a little. How little, though? Enough for 2 tickets to Moscow and some food, and some of their gear. That wouldn't ruin them. What if we left them their papers and the boat and made a deal with them not to report us? It wouldn't be easy to trust them. And how could we manage without papers? If we took their papers, they would have no choice but to report us. To prevent their doing so, we must tie them up here and now. Tie them up well and truly so that we should have 2 or 3 days' head start. But in that case, wouldn't it be better simply to... Collier came back and signalled that everything was all right up above. He was waiting for me to say Mahmadera. What was I to do? The slave camp of Ekibastus rose before my eyes. Could I go back to that? Surely we had the right... And suddenly something very light touched my legs. I looked down, something small and white. I bent over, it was a white kitten. It had jumped out of the boat, and with its tail stiff as a stalk in the air, it purred and rubbed itself against my legs. It didn't know what I was thinking. I felt as though the touch of this kitten had sapped my willpower. Stretched taut for 20 days, ever since I had slipped under the wire, it suddenly seemed to snap. I felt that whatever Collier might say to me now, I could never take their lives, nor even the money they had earned in the sweat of their brows. Still keeping a stern face, I said, "Right, wait here. We'll soon see what's what." We climbed the cliff. I had the papers in my hand. I told Collier what I was thinking. He said nothing. He disagreed, but he said nothing. That's how the world is arranged. They can take anyone's freedom from him without a qualm. If we want to take back the freedom which is our birthright, they make us pay with our lives and the lives of all whom we meet on the way. They can do anything, but we cannot. That's why they are stronger than we. Without coming to an agreement, we went down again. Only the lame man was by the boat. "Where's your wife?" "She was frightened. She ran off into the forest." "Here are your papers. You can go on your way." He thanks me and shouts into the forest, "Maria, come back. They're honest people." We push off. I row quickly. The ordinary working man, the man with the bad leg, suddenly remembers and shouts after me, "Comrade officer, we saw 2 chaps yesterday. Looked just like bandits. If we'd known, we'd have held the rotters." "Still feel sorry for him?" asks Collier. I say nothing. From that night, from the moment we went indoors for a warm-up, or perhaps when we met the white kitten, our escape began to go wrong. We had lost something. Our confidence, our tenacity, our ability to think straight, the instinctive understanding between us. Now that we were nearly in Omsk, we started making mistakes, pulling different ways. When runaways behave like that, they do not run much further. Toward morning, we abandoned the boat. We slept through the day in a haystack, but uneasily. Darkness fell. We were hungry. It was time to stew some meat, but we'd lost our bucket in the retreat. I decided to fry it. We found a tractor seat. That would do for a frying pan. The potatoes we could bake. Nearby stood a tall hut left behind by haymakers. In the mental blackout which had come upon me that day, I thought it a good idea to light my fire inside the hut. It would be invisible from all sides. Collier didn't want any supper at all. "Let's move on." Once again, we couldn't see eye to eye. I did light a fire in the hut, but I put too much wood on. The whole hut went up in flames, and I barely managed to crawl out. Then the fire jumped to the stack, the one in which we had spent the day, and it blazed up. Suddenly I felt sorry for that hay, so sweet-scented and so kind to us. I started scattering it and rolling on the ground in an attempt to put it out, to prevent the fire from spreading. Collier sat aloof, sulked, and offered no help. What a trail I'd left now! What a conflagration it was. The glow could be seen many kilometers away.
This book is continued on Cassette 6, Side 1.